This week's episode of A Cast of Kings is brought to you by Hover. Hover is the best way to buy and manage domain names. When you have a great idea, you want to secure a great domain name for it, you want something catchy and memorable to represent your project, Hover gives you exactly what you need to find the perfect domain for your idea. Joanna Robinson, this week, the promo code is hover.com/littlebirds. That's hover.com/littlebirds. You want to tell us why you chose that promo code?
Yeah, that's for the sparrows. I nailed it again.
Yeah, although why little birds, though? Didn't we...
Sparrows, you know, are little birds.
I see. Okay. Is their size part of the thing, or...?
Yeah, well...
Because I know, the title of the episode was High Sparrow.
Yeah.
So, is there a reason you didn't choose High Sparrow instead of little birds?
Because it's kind of... I guess it's cheating and boring to do the same thing as the episode title. I don't know.
No, I guess that's right. I
and Little Bird is also what the Hound called Sansa. So that's like an extra thing. But
wow. So it's like multiple layers.
Yeah, there you go.
Code. Well, very cool. if you use hover.com/littlebirds, you get 10% off your first purchase. Go to hover.com/littlebirds, get 10% off your first purchase, and you will also be supporting A Cast of Kings. Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Game of Thrones. I'm David Chen, and I've never read any of the books in George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
I'm Joanna Robinson. I've read every book in George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
And welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Well, we are delayed by a couple days this week. And I think, as Joanna Robinson predicted, anarchy was leased upon the world.
I don't think it was as bad as it might have been, because we announced last week.
We announced it right at the top of the episode. Right.
Most people knew to expect. People have been mostly patient. There are a few people who missed that warning, and I get the same way when my favorite podcasts don't show up when I expect them to. So it's kind of flattering. I appreciate it, guys.
Yes,
thanks.
Definitely. But sorry about that. I was in Boston for the weekend, and so couldn't record the show with Joanna as usual. But I am back in Seattle, and you should expect the show to resume at its normal schedule starting next week. If you're just tuning into A Cast of Kings for the first time, you should know what we do here on the podcast is we'll spoil everything through this week's episode of Game of Thrones, but nothing from future week's episodes, and that includes anything on the next time on preview. This week we'll spoil everything through Season 5, Episode 3 of Game of Thrones, entitled High Sparrow. Joanna Robinson, do you think we should... are we allowed to mention things that are like on the inside the episode section of Game of Thrones? Like, they have these things on HBO Go when I watch the show now. There's, like, inside the episode.
Yeah, like a little, like, two-minute thing from the creators, or minute and a half almost of, like, something you might not have known.
I think that's fair game. Because that doesn't talk about anything from future weeks. It just talks about, like, it dives deeper into their intentions behind what's going on in this week's episode. So you should consider that fair game for the podcast. And again, we'll be discussing everything through Season 5, Episode 3, High Sparrow. Sometimes, guys, in the course of recording this podcast, mistakes are made. Joanna Robinson from Vanity Fair occasionally makes mistakes.
I do.
You're always really paranoid about making mistakes, and... you have a higher standard than I do. I have no knowledge of anything, and I don't claim to. Whereas you are held up to the standard of a book reader and a show watcher. And so you need to know everything from both. And if you make any errors, the corrections will come raining down upon you. Well, this week I found out what that was like when I mistakenly mentioned that... the cause of gout was a deficiency of iodine.
Right.
And of course, this is in reference to last week's episode where we were talking about what's his name?
Prince Doran.
Doran, thank you, who has gout.
Right.
But in fact, as dozens of people pointed out, and actually, I'm guessing you only forwarded me a subset of these emails.
I would say I sent you like 5% of the emails.
You sent me 5% of the emails. Well, thank you for sparing me from that. As many people pointed out, gout is actually caused by an excess of uric acid, not a deficiency in iodine.
Right. And that's a goiter.
Right. In fact,
deficiency in iodine.
According to WebMD, your chances are getting gout are higher if you are overweight, drink too much alcohol, or eat too much meat and fish that are high in chemicals called purines. So potentially, living the life of a prince might predispose you to getting gout.
Well, it's interesting. We did talk about this. I always think, because Henry VIII had gout, so I always think of Henry VIII. I think of like a corpulent king eating some mutton or something like that, and that's how he got gout. And I think, yeah, they do call it the rich man's disease, I think is what they call gout. But we had actually a listener write in who had gout and said that there's like a genetic component to it too. And, you know, this listener said, I'm quite fit. You know, I run, I've been healthy all my life and I still got gout because it just runs in my family. So I think, you know, I did not bother to look up that claim to see if it's possibly true. But anyway, yes, Prince Duran, what we were talking about was Prince Duran does not strike one as like a Henry, like Robert Baratheon is a king that you were like, oh yeah, that guy, gout for sure. Like he's just eating mutton and drinking wine all day long. Right. But Prince Duran looks kind of trim.
He's pretty fit. Yeah. He's pretty fit. Well, that is definitely high on the list of things I'd never thought I would discuss on a Game of Thrones podcast, but here we are. We also got this email in from Mustafa. This is actually in response to our episode a couple weeks ago. And, you know, John Robinson, a couple weeks ago when the season premiere occurred, we talked about how people shouldn't torrent the show. They shouldn't download the episodes illegally. And we mentioned how HBO went out of their way to make it easier for people to obtain the show with simultaneous world premiere in many countries, 170 countries, and also the launch of HBO Now, which I don't think I mentioned is in the U.S. only.
Right.
So we got an email from Mustafa who wrote in, hey guys, glad the show is back, but I had to pause it and write this email because the way you spoke about those who torrent the show is just plain unfair and frankly unwarrantedly judgmental. I live in one of those quote-unquote 170 countries that supposedly now have the rights to broadcast Game of Thrones, and I swear I had good intentions. I pay for my music, and I, with all of my heart, wanted to watch Game of Thrones legitimately because I'm invested in the show and I want everyone involved to make some money. But man, is it one convoluted, inconvenient, and exasperatingly torturous path. First, I had to research which TV station had the rights to the series. It took me about 20 minutes to find out that the regional mother company of my cable provider bought the rights, and supposedly one of the 9 series channels included will show it. I went to the cable provider's website to see which channel Game of Thrones will be on. That website forces you to pick the channel you want before doing anything. I have no ability to make a general show search, and for some reason the show is not big in the culturally conservative African country I live in, and there are no ads, no promotions, nothing. I'm lucky enough to be one of the people who pay $100 per month for this elite cable provider, but that is not enough. Let's assume that I finally do find out which TV channel the show will be on. I'll need to find some way to time shift it, watch it live after midnight, no thanks. The TiVo equivalent that works with my provider's proprietary box would set me back another $200. I'm not a TV person. All this stuff is strange to me. And I only want to watch Game of Thrones and a couple of other shows. Streaming, you say? I don't have HBO Now here, and even if I did, the internet is not fast enough to let me watch it without frustration. I hope David understands that 170 countries is just a statistic, and that the devil in the details can still overpower many of us. So yes, my way is wrong and morally questionable, but I will not just sit here and listen to David moralizing about how easy it would be for me to watch Game of Thrones legitimately. End of rant. Well, consider Dave Chen chastised, Mustafa. I do think that he's right in correcting. I think Mustafa gets it every element correct, which is to say, yes, it is still morally questionable what you're doing, but I also have no right in saying that it is easy for you to watch the show. Anything to add to that, Jonah Robinson?
Yeah, and Mustafa was like one of several people. You know, we had people from like Canada, a couple different people write in just talking about how the setup is much more arduous in other countries, which is, you know, accurate. So I'm sorry if we got a little too high on our horses. I still stand by, you know, wanting people not to pirate the show. And I think a majority of our listeners, you know, are probably in the U.S., or maybe that's wrong, because actually we get feedback from all over the world. So, you know, it's good to remember that.
All right. So I think that's all we had to discuss in terms of emails. Let's just dive into this week's episode, right, Jonah Robinson?
Yeah, let's do it.
So the episode begins, and anything we want to say about the opening credits? I think we saw...
Oh, we saw Moat Cailin, which right. I thought, I mean, like they look at Moat Cailin in this episode, but it's not like they even go there. They
right.
just, 4 different characters stand on a cliff and look at it. I was complaining about this on the spoiler podcast. I do Storm of Spoilers. Like I don't, understand why we have Mokaelin and we don't have Dorne yet. If they go back to Dorne and they don't show me a tiny, adorable little Dorne in the opening credits, I'm going to get mad, is all I'm saying.
Okay, that's a very legitimate point. So so then we go to Braavos, first thing we do. So it's like a not direct continuation of last week because apparently some days have passed.
Right.
Which Arya points out. She's like, I've been sweeping for days, which is the only way we know how long she's been doing this. It could have been weeks for all right. we know. And yeah, so a lot of stuff happens in this plotline, John Robinson. that's the best I can describe it. Like, events happen with not too much context provided. What we do know is that Arya doesn't seem to like know what she's doing or why she's been brought there. We see a man come in. He gets a drink of water from this fountain, as I recall, and then dies.
Right.
And then is brought into a mysterious room. Right.
Right. Yeah.
Then later on, Arya is led into the room.
Yeah.
Or I think before that, does she have to surrender all her stuff? I forget the order.
She surrenders her stuff first before. Yeah.
She surrenders all of her stuff because then this I mean this girl comes in and says like starts tormenting her essentially and starts like hitting her and asking her who she is. Jaqen H'ghar comes in and puts a stop to that but says, you know, you have to give up all of your earthly possessions if you want to become no one, if you want to become a man of many faces.
Right.
So then there's this rather poignant scene where she goes out to the dock and starts throwing all of her stuff over the edge and stops at Needle. Like, she can't throw away Needle, the sword. Now, my initial take on this was that Needle was kind of the last – kind of a remnant of her father, like the one memory of her father, like a physical manifestation of her father that she had. Right.
Well, John gave her that sword, but like of her family for sure.
That's right. That's what I meant when I said father.
Oh, John,
and okay. Also her family.
Her family, yeah. Of being a Stark, I think
of being
a
Stark. That's kind of what I meant to say.
Stark. Yeah, yeah.
That's kind of what I meant to say. But then in the inside the episode with Benioff and Weiss after the show, they were talking about how that is the device with which she was going to exact her revenge for her father's death. That's why I got confused.
Mm, okay.
Like, they had explained that that's the sword she's going to use to kill all the people on her list.
Gotcha.
And that's why she couldn't let it go. That's their interpretation of it anyway.
Yeah, that makes sense too.
And so because she couldn't let it go, she had to hide the sword.
Right.
She couldn't throw it away. It's kind of an indication that, you know, she is not yet ready to become the person of many faces.
Right.
Did you have any other anything to add to that scene when she couldn't throw away her sword?
No, nothing to add to that. I do want to mention the actress. I have no idea what this character is going to do in the show, honestly, very honestly. But I do want to point out, because a couple people asked, that the actress playing the girl who's in the House of Black and White with Arya, her name is Faye Marseille, and she was in the movie Pride. She's also in an episode of Doctor Who, the Christmas special of Doctor Who. She's a great young British actress. So I actually didn't know she was cast this season. I kind of missed it. I don't know how much they're going to use her, because all the time they'll put like these great British actors in like one episode. So I have no idea.
Right.
But
well, why do you say you have no idea? Because is it because this is deviating from the books at this point?
Or? Well, they're deviating so much. I just don't want to make any assurances this season.
Right.
They're deviating so much.
Right.
She is a character in the book. She's called the Waif. She looks, you know, in the grand tradition of Game of Thrones, she's a lot prettier on the show than she is in the books. But yeah, I mean, are you enjoying this House of Black and White stuff? Because my reading of most viewers who haven't read the books is that they're kind of bored. It's kind of gloomy, and it was kind of a little too Karate Kid for people's taste this week's episode. Were you bored at all?
I guess I would just say it's a bit inscrutable.
Yeah,
they're just showing you a bunch of stuff that's happening,
right,
without much connective tissue or explanation or context. It's like,
right,
here's a dead person. We have no idea where this person came from and
right,
what they're doing to them and how this connects at all with Arya's mission to become, you know, like, it's just all this stuff is just throwing it at you. And so it's difficult to enjoy to that extent.
Right.
And maybe later on, all of it's going to lock into place and we're going to say, oh, now I get why they showed it to you that way. I mean, we've seen with like Theon and Zero Dark Greyjoy in, I think it was season 3.
Yeah.
Would say. that, you know, like I still think the amount of torture shown that season was a bit excessive. But as we've continued this podcast, I learned to question less some of the things that were shown. So I'm not enjoying it in this episode, but I'm not dismissing the possibility that I'll enjoy it in retrospect later on.
And I think that's exactly right. I mean, I'm not sitting here promising an amazing payoff. I'm just saying that, like, it is – I think the show – I think the Theon parallel is the exact right and perfect one in terms of what is this, what is this? And then, you know, to skip ahead a little bit in this episode briefly, to see Alfie Allen sort of hanging around the frame looking shell-shocked makes sense because we had to go through all that
right.
stuff.
If you, like, that is more impactful because you've seen
right.
All the – countless scenes of torture that he's had to endure. So maybe one day, like, I guess the difference there is, well, no, I don't want to say there is a difference because, like, we see the purpose of the torture later on, and maybe we'll see the purpose of these completely inscrutable actions later on as well.
Right. So. But I do want to, like, assure listeners who haven't read the books that if you are confused, it's fine. And I'm not going to explain it to you because I don't think you're supposed to know yet. So just, yeah, someone died. Did they poison him? Was he dying anyway? Question mark. Right. What are they doing with that body? Question mark. You know,
right.
Exactly.
Okay. So that's what's going on at Braavos this week. Let's move on to King's Landing. I think we start in with the wedding pretty early.
Yeah.
Actually, we start in with the lead up to the wedding with Cersei arriving and people
right.
calling out Margaery's name. And
yeah.
We kind of this makes like the flashback from the season premiere.
Yeah.
Kind of, you know, callbacks to that about like that Cersei is essentially being replaced.
Right.
And yeah, so the wedding happens and then we get a glimpse of their wedding night, which is awesome.
Yeah,
right?
Tommen living the dream.
He's living the dream, sleeping with Natalie Dormer apparently many, many times in the course of one evening. And I just felt like, man, I felt some sense of relief on behalf of Margaery, who was finally able to consummate a marriage, this being the third time I think she's attempted to do so without success.
I don't think she was married to Renly yet, but I think she was his betrothed.
Right. She was
but yeah,
betrothed.
She did not close the deal with him.
Nor with Joffrey.
Joffrey died. So yeah, third time's a charm for Margaery. That was my favorite part of that scene where he was like, Queen Margaery, doesn't that sound weird to you? And she was like, yeah, as if she hasn't been chanting it into a mirror like her whole entire life. As if she doesn't have Queen Margaery doodle on every Trapper Keeper she's ever owned.
Right,
so.
Right.
Yeah, so weird. Ugh, I just never thought this would happen to me.
Also the fact that she actually the dude that she married that survived is actually probably the best dude out of all of them, right?
Yeah. I mean, I like Renly well enough, but he was gay. At least, you know, Tommen is really, really into her.
Right.
And way better than the last Baratheon she married, for sure. She traded up, so I'm sure she's delighted.
Right.
And much more malleable, you know?
That's
like,
right. Much more easy to manipulate. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is Margaery's whole thing. So.
Right. I guess...
But she's such, like, I'm really happy about, you know, let's just keep it contained in the span of this episode. This is, like, the nicest wedding we've ever seen on Game of Thrones. Because, right? Because it's, like, a victimless crime. Like, yeah, he's a little too young for what's happening. But, like, she's gonna, you know, her agenda is to manipulate him, but, like, to do it so nicely that he'll never notice.
Right.
You know? And then he's super nice and will, you know, probably do whatever she says. So that's as close to a happy ending as you often get in
yep.
Westeros, I think. So.
That's as close to a happy ending as you get on Game of Thrones, although
yeah.
I just have a feeling it's not going to end that happily for one of the characters in play here. Anyway, I mean, we get a taste of what's going on when she kind of drops in these hints, like, don't you think your mom would be happier elsewhere?
Yeah.
Very subtle. Very subtle. And then right after the follow-up scene where Tommen talks to Cersei about how yeah, like, she basically is repeating what Margaery is saying.
Yes, Cersei's trying to, like undercut Margaery. Like, she's like, she's very pretty, but she looks like a doll. Do you think she's smart? Like, all these, like, really, really shitty, insidious stuff. But, like, Margaery already got in there.
She's, like
Margaery,
next level. Like,
yeah.
Margaery is on, like, next level in a way that Cersei could never be.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah. Margie's got game, man.
Yeah. I mean, Tommen clearly is really taken with her, and there's very little that's going to trump that, right?
And it's easy. I mean, and that's even more apparent when you get the scene with Marjorie and Cersei. And right. That's one of my favorite scenes in the episode is...
Maybe of the whole series, I would
yeah.
say.
Yeah.
I mean, because this is such a masterclass in passive aggression.
Yes.
It's incredible. Because this scene, actually, I just got an idea for my newest video essay. This scene needs a video version where it's like what they're saying and what they
subtitles.
Actually mean. Yeah, subtitles of like what they actually mean.
The Annie Hall thing. I love
right.
it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Mother. Welcome. Don't you look lovely? Marriage agrees with you. Can we bring you anything to eat or drink? I wish we had some wine for you. It's a bit early in the day for us. No, I can't stay. I just wanted to let you know if there's ever anything I can do for you. You were very sweet. Tommen seems quite taken with his new queen. I absolutely adore him. You raised a gallant young man. I'm forever grateful. Good. Good. I'm glad to hear you're happy. Ecstatic. I really am. Exhausted, to be honest, but what could I expect? He is half lion, half stag. I'll leave you to it then. Oh, forgive me. I haven't been at court for long. I get so confused. What's the proper way to address you now? Queen Mother or Dowager Queen? There's no need for such formalities. In any event, judging from the King's enthusiasm, the Queen Mother will be a Queen Grandmother soon. Wouldn't that be a lovely day? Can you imagine the celebrations? They'll ring the bells all day and night. Remember, anything you need.
It is incredible. And so what is it that what would your interpretation of Cersei's words be in this scene? Because I think Margaery is pretty clearly trying to rub it in Cersei's face that she's no longer the queen.
That she's old, that she's an alcoholic, right. Like all sort of stuff.
That she's a dowager.
Yeah, yeah.
Queen. Dowager queen, by the way, is the title of someone who's widow of a king, right?
Yeah. But it always implies old to me. The Dowager Countess on Downton Abbey, Maggie Smith, you know, like,
yep.
You don't, there are no like sprightly young dowagers right. hanging around the place. Right. So yeah, I mean, queen, my
all
name,
the middle-aged dowagers listening to this podcast just got really offended. Jonah Robinson.
I hope you don't refer to yourself as a dowager. but anyway, what I was going to say is, what is Cersei saying? You know, because she keeps saying, like, anything you need. Like, she's trying to be fake polite. Right. But maybe she just didn't maybe she just didn't expect Margaery to have so much game.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, maybe she went in and just went like, okay, I'm going to make nice with her. She's got influence on my son. I'm going to make nice with her and deal with her later. And then she goes in there and Margaery's like, oh, I'm not making nice with you. I don't have to anymore.
Well, you know, I don't. I mean, she made incredibly nice with her, I would say.
No, but she's not. No, she's not making that. Like, because that phrase means like actually
being nice yourself.
Right.
Whereas they're both being incredibly passive aggressive.
Right.
Yeah.
But with smiles. Yeah.
Right.
Fake compliments.
To the outside, they look like they're being nice to each other. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yep.
I did like this lovely bit of sound editing in the episode where, as Cersei is walking away, you hear the laughter. Maidens or whatever they are. I don't know who they are. Whoever Margaery is talking to.
Her entourage.
Her entourage. Yeah, sorry. I'm sorry. I don't know the correct terminology. I don't know the
name. No. That's no. I think what would be the correct terminology? Retinue, maybe? But yeah. Mm. I was more thinking of like
nice.
Her posse.
That's a Vanity Fair vocabulary there.
Retinue. Watch me use it wrong. They're mean girls, basically, right? She's Regina George with like her mean girls. So
yeah. So what else happens in King's Landing? A few other plot details are introduced. Firstly, we get a scene with the Septon. So there's some female nudity in this episode in what looks like Littlefinger's old brothel, right?
It is, yeah.
And the Septon appears to be playing some kind – like, what was going on there? Can you explain that?
Well, yeah. Sorry. It was a religious cosplay. I think Oliver, who's the, you know, the manager of Littlefinger's brothel at this point, right, was playing a Septon. And, you know, the Septon was playing, I don't know. Anyway, basically the girls were dressed as the seven gods of the faith.
Gotcha.
So there was the stranger and the, like, what, you know, all the crone and, like, all the gods that we've seen. And he picked, you know, which two he wanted. So it's like, is if you went to a brothel and someone dressed as Zeus and Hera and Hephaestus and whatever, and you're like, okay, I want Aphrodite and, you know, Apollo. And
which would be my first two choices.
I mean, I think so, right?
Maybe Mercury a close third.
But I loved the stranger one because she had her hair in front of her face.
Right.
That looked really cool. But I think she was also, it was the maiden. The one who played the maiden was the one who, like, had the, let's say, crotch shot. Like, just her crotch coming right at the camera was that shot. We won't talk too long about this, but that's a thing that happened.
Yeah, so. It happened, for sure. So then Loras comes in and breaks the whole party up.
Lancel,
sorry.
I wrote that.
No worries. I knew it was one of the L people. And he comes in, breaks up the party, and then forces the Septon to walk down the street naked while they whip him.
Right.
Leaving him for dead in a ditch, it sounds like. Although at that, like, we never see the ending. We only hear the Septon's description of the ending, and he's not exactly a reliable narrator.
Right.
So Septon goes and complains to the small council, and this causes Cersei to seek out the High Sparrow, correct?
Right.
Who
yeah.
is the leader of the sparrows?
Yes. Before we get to him really quickly, I do want to mention couple things about the small council scene, which is I loved that Pycelle was sort of like sticking up for the High Septon because we've seen Pycelle with his own prostitutes.
Correct.
So we know that he's like, come on. Qyburn had a great line in that scene when the Septon didn't know his name and Qyburn was just like, doesn't matter. Like, it was just so
right.
cool.
Yes, that was awesome. He is cool as a cucumber throughout the entire show.
He is so great.
Yeah.
And then I did want to mention, you know, you took your licks at the top of the episode. I want to mention I was remiss for not talking about Kevin Lannister's moment in the Small Council
last week.
We got a lot of emails about that.
Well,
you
that's
guys,
not just
right.
you, John Robinson from Vanity Fair. That's also me as well. Like, I did not bring it up either.
We forgot to talk about Kevin Lannister, who had that great drop the mic moment on Cersei, basically telling her she's not her father. And yeah, so sorry we forgot to mention Kevin and the whole small council situation.
Yeah. Well, very good highlights from that scene. And then Cersei goes to seek out the High Sparrow, who's presumably the leader of this group of zealots.
Right.
And she goes to the heart of the city where she finds this dude. I like how she's carrying a little, like, Vicks VapoRub container with her to avoid the smell.
Oh, like, yeah.
I was like, what is in that mixture?
You yeah. know,
that's got to be pretty amazing. So anyway, she goes and seeks out the guy, and he's played by Jonathan Pryce, who's a
yes.
great actor.
Great.
Love him in those Infinity commercials. And they have a little exchange where essentially Cersei tries to kind of get his allegiance, right? Because she sees the power – from my perspective, she sees the power kind of flowing away from her towards Margaery, and she needs to make whatever ally she can.
My thoughts on the matter are in line with your own. The High Septon's behavior was corrosive, as was his attitude. Having a man like that reside in this sept eats away at the faith from the inside. So now he resides in the Red Keep dungeons instead. The faith and the crown are the two pillars that hold up this world. One collapses, so does the other. We must do everything necessary to protect one another.
What was your interpretation of this scene?
Yeah, I think that's a good that's a good interpretation, that she needs to amass power and she sees that he's brazen enough to walk in and do this to a High Septon, that this is someone who wields a lot of influence and, and has the support of the people, a certain subset of the people anyway. This is one of the scenes, by the way, that showed up on that, A Day in the Life of Game of Thrones thing that they did special, and it was my favorite part of the special because you saw the director, who was what, Mark someone. You saw him inspecting the extras and being like, they don't look impoverished enough. He's like, that one needs fewer teeth. That one needs to be dirtier. Like, just going around just like basically making them look more and more miserable. And I think it paid off. Those people looked really, really rough. And that's, I mean, the Lannisters and the Baratheons did that to their city. Like, they bankrupt the, you know, like, we've seen that influence. And so, you know, this is what Cersei has wrought, and this is why this religious sect has risen to power, because of these, they're serving the neglected, the impoverished of the city. So,
very cool. And one thing also worth pointing out is that she reveals the fate of the Septon, which is that he's rotting in a dungeon.
Yeah.
I would say, from my perspective, like, I didn't know if that was true or not, or if she's just telling that to the High Sparrow. I don't know. I guess we will hopefully find out at some point. But I would say, like, my inclination is that that's true, because it makes sense given what we've seen of how Cersei treated the Septon. But it did strike me that it's possible she could be lying about that. That's all.
It's possible Cersei could be lying at any minute.
Yeah, exactly. So I just wanted to point that out.
Real quick Jonathan Pryce note, my favorite thing that he did before the season started is he narrated this – a listener pointed this out to me. He narrated this cool commercial for the BBC Sports called Six Nations Rugby Union Championship. They did like a Game of Thrones promo of like the Six Nations – I mean, this is such like a weird thing, but it's a really well-done commercial, and he narrates the whole thing and just talks about like – you know, it's basically talking about like the Starks and the Lannisters, except it's, you know, like Wales and Scotland and stuff like that. So – anyway, okay, if you want to Google that and watch it, it's kind of cool visually. Well, and
my favorite thing, John Robinson, is Brazil, the 1985.
I meant Barry related Gilliam to Game of Thrones.
I'm just messing. All right.
But he's great in Brazil.
The only other thing that happened in King's Landing worth pointing out is we got a scene with Qyburn. Now, one thing, I think I pointed this out last episode, we never found out what happened with the mountain.
Yeah.
And I think it's implied that that's the mountain under that cloth, right?
Yeah.
We don't know for a fact. Yeah. But, you know, Cersei tells Qyburn to send a raven to Littlefinger, which we'll discuss later.
Right.
I kind of like how the shot lingers on Qyburn writing, and the show would never linger on that shot unless something was going to happen. So even though you anticipate it, even when it happened, it's still kind of startled me. You know
what
I mean?
The timing was so good because they led the camera on him so long.
Yeah, it was
with
quite,
him just writing.
It was like 5 seconds. Right? That it just nothing. But and you just think to yourself, man, there's got to be some kind of purpose for this. And of course there is. And it is, it's very impressive. So yeah. I love the way he talks to it too.
Like he's just like shh.
Yeah,
he just like, gestures it.
It can it can understand English, which is like even more terrifying somehow. like it has conscious thought, even though it is only capable of involuntary spasms.
And he doesn't even flinch, as you mentioned, cool as a cucumber. Just
yep, yep. Mm-hmm. He's awesome. So, all right, so that's what happened at King's Landing this week. Let's discuss one more plot line here. Let's talk about the wall. How about that? That's a good place to go to. So.
Yeah.
We're kind of going out of order in the episode now, but that's okay. So with the wall, we have a sort of continuation of last episode where John has just been made, what is it called?
Lord Commander.
Lord Commander of the wall, which, as you pointed out in last episode, holds a lot of power. They're really doing a lot to build up this non-book character Ollie in the show,
yeah.
which I like. What is that? What is that scoffing reaction, John Robinson?
I just don't know I have a theory about what they're doing, but it's confusing to me. And probably just frustrated because, you know, I can't lord my knowledge over everyone.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like to me. Because for me, it's quite an exciting plot line.
But do you like – I mean, I know you nailed it with Ollie last season, so you're, like, emotionally attached to this character. But, like, taking that aside, your victory, your triumph away, like, do you actually like this Ollie character? Is he interesting?
Well, I think they're using him well so far.
Okay.
I mean, he came back at a very he's gotten as much character development as a lot of people in the show. Let's put it that way.
Reaction shots of him like looking adoringly at John.
Okay, firstly, you're really underselling the Ollie character development right now. Okay, I mean, he killed Ygritte, right? Which is like a total awesome revenge. He was training with John like a couple weeks ago. He is apparently John's new steward. John's training him up. He was able to recite the oath. He looked on disapprovingly at the thing with the Mance Rayder a couple weeks. You know.
Okay, so
I basically just named the totality of all of his scenes. But still, that's more than some people on the show get.
Okay, so are you telling me, Dave Chen, that the way that you want it to go is that at the end of all this, Ollie is sitting on the Iron Throne?
That is exactly the thing I'm advocating for.
All right.
I mean, if he's a non-book character, I would say more likely than not he's going to die a horrible death. That's my guess. Because that has generally been the plight of non-book characters.
Oh, yes? Poor Roz. Rest in peace.
So we'll see. Alternatively, maybe he becomes Lord Commander. Do you think of that, John Robinson?
I mean, that's John's plan. That's John's 50-year plan or whatever. So.
So there you go. Anyway, so they have Stannis tries to convince him to become a Stark and help him rally the North, which John was planning on rejecting last week and now officially rejects.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But Davos brings up a really good point, which is, hey, sometimes protecting the North is more than just – like sometimes you don't need to take the letter of the law so seriously, right? Maybe the spirit of the law is what's going to guide you to protect the North rather than just standing by this wall.
Here's the thing that I want to say. Stannis might be our least charismatic leader, like the least charismatic person calling themselves king or queen these days. But God, he has the best sidekick in Davos. Like, I want Davos to give me advice on everything.
Yeah. Not only is he a great sidekick, John Robinson from Vanity Fair, but he also knows how to strategically use Ollie for his purposes.
Yeah, that's true.
When he
that's
asks him to recite the oath. So yeah. Think about that.
I will.
I don't think you will.
But I mean, we'll get to this. But basically, Stannis offers – he uses the word vengeance, and he offers Jon vengeance on the Boltons, basically.
Right.
And Jon says no. And we will get to later someone who says yes. But that's an interesting parallel, I thought.
Okay. So – Here's my one – like people hate Jon Snow. They think he's the worst character. As we've discussed in previous weeks, I'm actually quite a fan of his plotline.
Oh, I'm team Jon Snow now.
We're team Jon Snow. I would say the one thing that I'm a little bit kind of – I feel like was a little bit elided in terms of his character development is his willingness to follow the oath kind of unequivocally now, which we saw he was very willing to bend those rules early on. And I don't think that like cementing of his loyalty to the oath, I don't know that I feel like it really happened convincingly on the screen.
Well, I think you're right that on the screen, and I don't even have like a good, maybe there's some better evidence in the book, but I would say one good interpretation is that he betrayed his oath before and
saw what came of it.
Right. So for him to swerve back towards, okay, bad things happen when I break this oath, I'm swerving back to being, you know, as honorable as my, you know, as Ned Stark. So.
Yeah. I'm not saying, wow, that's incredibly unconvincing. I'm just saying, I do wonder if there was a way they could have put a little bit more of that on the screen.
I think like he could have said to Sam at some point, like, yeah, like in last week's episode almost, like, Sam's like, you don't want to do this? He's like, we saw what happened last time I betrayed my oath. Like, one line. I mean, it sounds really inorganic when I say it, but he could have maybe done it. So.
I think what we've learned here is you should write for Game of Thrones.
I don't think so. Yeah, I would kill Ollie next week. So.
Yeah, that is true. So then John has his first meeting with all the Night's Watchmen.
A+.
And it goes swimmingly well. He assigns Sir Alistair to some place and then assigns Janice Lynn to another place, which is a rather reasonable assignment because if that place is really in the boonies, as Slint implies, Slint is not exactly their bravest warrior. So
To be a little clearer on it, like Stannis told Jon to send Alistair Thorne away because he's his enemy.
Yep.
But Jon
doesn't.
Being right? smart – rewards Alistair and gives him a really high ranking position, which is First Ranger, which is, I think what his uncle Benjen was. And, you know, like First Ranger is a really like honored position. And, it's a position that requires you to leave a lot, go north of the wall. Like, that's what the Rangers do, but it's still an honor, you know? Right. So
that definitely came across in the show.
Move. Yeah. Just a smart, smart move that Stannis is like, send him away to whatever. Like, he basically wanted him to give him the Janice Slint treatment. And John recognized, no, you don't treat this guy like Janice Slint. You treat Janice Slint like Janice Slint.
Right.
And you reward this guy, so then he becomes your ally.
That was an amazing line by Stannis when he says, you know, I thought it was wise to keep your enemies close. And he said, whoever says that never had many enemies.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I thought is amazing, because that keep your enemies close thing, that is a Machiavellian, you know, suggestion that persists to this day.
Right.
So it kind of had this weird thing of, like, echoing to today's times that, like, that piece of advice from Stannis could still apply to today's times, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So I really love that, and the way Stannis delivers it, you know, in a no-nonsense tone. Really enjoyed that. So thank you for the context on First Ranger. So Janice Slint not only refuses the assignment, but does it in a really belligerent way.
And misreads the room.
He thought he could rally everyone around.
Rally everyone around, have Alistair Thorne on his side.
Right. It's like
name check his friends in the Capitol. No.
He's like one of those people that tries to start a chant and no one else joins in.
Oh.
Or like tries to start a slow clap and like it doesn't succeed, you know?
Yeah.
It basically doesn't go well for him. And then at the end, you know, he begs for forgiveness and Jon Snow doesn't give it to him. Now, what is your interpretation of this scene?
Well, okay, so yeah, basically Janice Slint does the whole, like, Britt McHenry, like, do you know how important I am sort of thing. And John's like, you don't understand how important I am. I am Lord Commander. He needs to show a show of strength, authority, and it recalls, you know, the first scene we saw with Ned Stark cutting off the head of someone who...
The deserter.
You know, disobeys their oath, you know, right. And that's basically what Janice Slint is doing, is by refusing to take a direct order from Lord Commander, he's breaking his vow.
Right. And also call back to Ned Stark's mantra that whoever passes the sentence should also swing the sword.
Swing the sword. Yeah. And we've seen this happen over and over again in the show. I did write about this, but we saw Rob do it. He did it pretty well. Theon did it really poorly. Jon actually was supposed to behead Ygritte, and he couldn't go through with this. So this shows like some development for Rob. For Jon, yeah. And then, of course, last week episode, we saw Dany behead someone.
Headings going on left.
Yeah, a lot, you know. But she didn't swing the sword. And not only that, she flinched. I mean, she did not do it the Ned Stark way. John did it the Ned Stark way. And we know that Ned Stark didn't come to a good end. Like, Stannis reminded us of that in this episode. But I think we as viewers felt like this was a really important, good, strong moment for Jon Snow. Right?
Right. Yeah. No, I agree. And in the inside the episode that Weiss and Benioff, you know, they said in interviews that it's – he's basically never going to get the men's respect if he allows himself to be disrespected in this way at their first meeting.
Right.
At the first meeting.
There for the book readers, I will say really quickly that there's a line from the book that's very famous, I guess, to a certain subset of people, where Jon goes, Ed, fetch me the block.
Mm-hmm.
And they change in the show to Ollie, fetch me my sword.
Which, by the way, again, you're just seeing how amazing Ollie is serving as a plot device.
I'm seeing how the show is in love with Ollie and, like, short-shrifted Ed. But basically, like, this is a very iconic line for Jon Snow. Like, this is when Jon Snow becomes a man almost, right? Mm-hmm. Is when he's like, Ed, fetch me the block. Like, I'm gonna man up right now. And they changed it, and they did the same thing last season too, an iconic book line. They changed only Kat to, like, your sister or whatever it was. And it's fine. I mean, it's not the end of the world. I get why book readers are attached to it and upset. Show watchers will not notice. It doesn't matter. And Ed did, in fact, fetch the block. So, you know, that still happened.
In the movie Office Space, they were saying how there's that exchange where he's talking about how to survive in prison. And he's saying, the only way to survive in prison is you beat someone up the first day really bad or become someone's bitch. That's what he said. And it felt like this is John's way of doing the first thing.
Yeah. Right?
He had to just beat someone up real bad. And by beat someone up, I mean behead someone the first day.
Uh-huh.
Or else, you know, he would forever be under ridicule. By the way, amazing shot when Slint is actually beheaded.
Right.
I believe it's like a long continuous shot that kind of pushes in on John. And you kind of see, I mean, the effect of his head getting chopped off is very convincing. I'll just put it that way.
Yeah, but having gone through and watched every single beheading on Game of Thrones, as I did this last week, it's kind of amazing how it's progressed.
Right.
Because with Ned and Rob, they did like a faraway shot.
Right.
And yep. With Theon, like you just see Theon hacking and blood coming up, and then you see the head roll, but you don't see the actual beheading.
Right.
With Ned, it's really weird. It's obviously
you
like
mean John?
With Ned.
Oh,
it's
with Ned.
It's like CG'd in some when Ned.
Oh
got
yeah,
his
yeah.
Head
like you
up.
See his head come off.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, you don't. It like cuts to Arya, and if this is a weird thing, but if you make a GIF of that scene, it looks like the sword just slices through nothing because. It's like obviously CG'd in some way. This is the best. This is the best one yet.
This was the most convincing beheading.
The blood spurting.
Right.
It was pretty great. Yeah.
Right. So it is curious to reflect on that, which I also have at great length this week. Like whether that was an artistic choice or whether that was because of budgetary constraints. Right.
Right. Yeah.
I do wonder, like, if you think about like you look back on the show. Is there an artistic reason for making the beheadings more and more graphic, or at least this one really graphic?
I think we have to be honest with ourselves and say they shot it from far away the first couple seasons. Like, because most of the beheadings happen in season two, when I still don't think they had like the mega budget that they have now.
Right.
So.
I think the budget for like season three or four, it was like, I think I read it was around $70 million for all 10 episodes. So it's not nothing. It's not nothing they got.
Right.
But, you know, they probably have even more this season. So Jon Snow had to cut a dude's head off to prove that he was a great leader.
True.
But you know what would be a much easier way of communicating ideas to a large group of people, John Robinson?
What's that?
It would be creating a website, John Robinson. And you know what you need to create a website? An awesome domain name.
How do you get one of those?
It's super hard because a lot of domain name registrars suck. If only there was an amazing domain name registrar that was easy to use, didn't try to upsell you on useless stuff. Thankfully, there is. It's called Hover. And you can get 10% off your first order at hover.com/littlebirds. That's hover.com/littlebirds. If you have ever registered a domain name, you know that some companies make it a really unpleasant experience. They make it complicated to just buy what you need. They try to upsell you with stuff you don't need. And they try to make you pay extra to upgrade to things that shouldn't even be included. Hover doesn't believe in heavy-handed upselling. Instead of charging you for something that should just be free, Hover includes everything you need with your domain. You get a smart control panel, and Whois privacy is always free on every domain that supports it. This is not a well-known fact, but when you register a domain name, basically like anyone can look up who that domain name is registered to. Were you aware of this fact, John Robinson?
No, I didn't know that. That's like Roose Bolton opening a message that was sealed and meant only for your eyes.
That's wow, nice. Compare. I don't think it's quite that extreme.
Okay, maybe not.
Of piracy, but it's pretty close. It's pretty close that anyone can just know your home address because you want to start a website. People can know what your address is. That doesn't seem fair.
No.
And I can tell you, like other websites, they make you pay for privacy. But Hover.com. Includes Whois privacy free on every domain that supports it. They even offer free valet transfer service, so you can skip the hassle of trying to move your domains over from where they're currently registered, because some registrars love to make it difficult to do that. So hover.com/littlebirds, an awesome service, and we hope you'll support them. They are one of our two sponsors getting us through this entire season of A Cast of Kings. So if you have an idea, if you want to communicate it forcefully as a beheading, but not with as much blood or regret. I'd recommend hover.com/littlebirds. Get 10% off your first order if you use that at checkout. So that is who sponsored us for this episode of A Cast of Kings. But in addition to that, John Robinson from Vanity Fair, we also had a lot of people who supported us via Kickstarter, wanted to register their support of the show. And those people include who, John Robinson?
First, we got to say happy birthday to Greg Jagger from Bonnie Washaleski. Then we need to thank Jim Nardakia. God, I always get that one wrong, too. Like 3 years he supported us. Joe Mixitz, Daniela Gonzalez Aldape, Christina Jackson, Nate Boudreau, host of the Nate Team Podcast, find it on iTunes, David the Jax Weibel, Tapio Leopold, Emily Burnham, Jasper Hayward, Kip Palalis, I know that one, I can do that one, John Stahl, Jesse Jackson, and R.J. Bubel.
I am convinced that people are just making up names for us to butcher on the show.
Like, you got a doozy in your.
I do not think that Tapio Leopold is a real person.
I think
that's like Fox Mulder. That cannot possibly be a real name. All right, Torgeir Henriksen, James Nicholson, Vincent Multileone, Evan Balfour, Andrew Gormley, Zach Z-Man Johnson, David Saff, Matt Lubniewski, Tobias Jagerbrot.
Nice.
So that's as close as we're going to get on that one. Mike Aparicio, Patrick Hefner, Abe Zabi, and Tina Shepard. Thank you guys so much for your donations to the Cast of Kings Kickstarter. And thanks again to Hover.com/LittleBirds for sponsoring us this episode. So
I won't say which one because it's favoritism. I will just say this. That occasionally, like, names come up that we've heard, like, year in, year out. Yes. And it's just really nice and familiar. I'm like, oh, that one. Yay.
It's like a warm blanket that we can't wait to butcher. So, yes, thank you to all the people who support us year after year, including all
the
people.
And for the newcomers, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, those people too, whatever. No, seriously, though, we're really grateful for everyone who throws the support behind the show. So, a couple of plot lines left to discuss this episode. Firstly, we had some more action at Winterfell. Actually, the most substantial things happened at Winterfell and Volantis this episode, right? So at Winterfell, we see a bunch of actual flayed people for the first time, right?
Yeah.
Which is pretty disgusting.
Pretty gnarly.
We see Theon, like, kind of, I guess he's doing what appears to be like slave work. And Ramsay and Roose Bolton planning, scheming away what the future is going to be.
Did that for me, the flayed men sort of dangling there felt like a callback to when Theon burnt those boys when he was in charge of Winterfell in season 2.
Yeah.
And those two boys were hanging from the that were supposedly Bran and Rickon but weren't. So I couldn't tell. My interpretation was he was looking at them not only horrified by, you know, what the Boltons do, but also by what he himself did not too long ago.
Right. And there's, you know, there's other callbacks from his past life as well, obviously seeing Sansa. So yeah. Maybe this episode's like a reminder of his past life.
And possibly his humanity, because at this point in the books, he's called Reek. Like, he's not even called Theon anymore.
Right.
They just call him Reek. I mean, and they do in the show, too. But, yeah, like, right. To more... even more of a degree in the book. So
Ramsay has tried to disabuse him of his notion of humanity at this point. So,
right.
And has succeeded to a large degree. So this is probably this, like major deviations going on from the book here, apparently. Right, Joanna Robinson?
Yeah.
I don't even know how best to describe the events that happened. But I mean, the biggest thing is that Sansa is promised to Ramsay Bolton.
Right.
And that happened last episode, but we didn't learn what it really was until this episode.
Right.
And Sansa is not happy with this prospect, and she doesn't even realize how much of a psychopath Ramsay is.
Like, and I don't know if this is your interpretation, but I think Littlefinger doesn't even know how much of a psycho Ramsay is.
Right.
Like I am loath to underestimate Littlefinger. He knows everything.
Right.
But why
would he know? Like, there's no reason he would know.
But he just knows so much. Like, he has spies everywhere. Like, right. he should know. But Ramsay, because he was a bastard, because the Bolton house wasn't important enough, just doesn't seem to know that Ramsay is an absolute psychopath. So, and I don't think he would have, you know, no matter what the plan of vengeance is or whatever his long game is, I don't think he would have walked Sansa into that situation if he had known. Yeah.
Hmm. Interesting. Or you could take the opposite interpretation that he does know, and that's how ruthless he is. That was my first reaction, is that Littlefinger, you know, when he's giving Sansa that talk and talking her down from the ledge, I see nothing but cold calculation on Littlefinger's part, at least. Right?
I think it's calculated. It is all one big, long let's fuck over the Boltons sort of plan, whatever it may be, however it may play out.
Lannisters, I think you mean to say.
Like, I thought when he was telling Sansa, like, avenge them, he's saying, the Boltons who killed your family, let's go and avenge your family.
That is not how I interpreted it.
Okay. I'm not, like, as you mentioned, this doesn't happen in the book, so I'm not using book knowledge. This is just my interpretation of the show, which is that, I mean, both the Lannisters.
I thought he was referring to the Lannisters when he said avenge them.
But, like, the people who killed Catelyn, and that's number one on Littlefinger's hit list, right? Because, like, whatever you want to believe about Littlefinger, you must believe, to understand his character, that he loved Catelyn. He loved Catelyn Stark. The people who killed Catelyn Stark are number one on his hit list. The people who killed Catelyn Stark are the Freys and the Boltons. And the Lannisters, by extension. Of them are on his list.
I don't know, Jonah Robinson. I don't know if I feel the same way. I feel like Littlefinger's motivations are far from clear at this point. That's what I would say. I think you're advocating a very plausible version of events, and I don't know that it's that clear.
Obviously, on Littlefinger's mind at all time is power, how he can get more, who is the strongest ally. And they talk a lot in this episode, you know, because it's not how it is in the books, I think they need to do a lot of explaining and sort of manipulating to make it work, make motivations work. And so you do hear Tywin tell – I mean, you hear Littlefinger tell Roose, I'm not as beholden to the Lannisters anymore because Tywin isn't there anymore. And Roose is the same thing about the Lannisters. Like, our Lannisters were our allies, but now that Tywin's dead, they're not as powerful and I don't care about pissing them off anymore. Because Cersei's weak, Tommen's weak, Jaime's weak. Without Tywin holding them together, they're not the formidable, you know, family they once were. They both expressed that, like, that the lack of Tywin is why they can abandon their allegiances to the Lannisters and risk angering everyone by bringing Sansa into this marriage.
Okay, so for what it's worth, so...
Because she's fugitive number one.
Right.
You know, Cersei is out for Sansa, right?
So I'm inclined to believe Jonah Robinson just because she knows way more about the books and the show probably than me. So, like, let's just, like, I'm just put that out there. I guess my initial reading was that when he said avenge them, right, what he wasn't saying was anything specific about doing stuff to the Boltons, but just that if you do not take control of this situation by marrying Ramsay, you leave yourself with zero options. That was my initial reaction. I'm ready to be proven wrong or talked down, but I guess that's kind of my interpretation, was that he was just saying, like, you must, like, you can take control of the situation by being an active participant in this marriage and you know, giving yourself more options than you would have if you didn't participate in it.
I mean, I think that's certainly true, but it's also, like, it's so traumatic for Sansa to go into Winterfell,
right,
and marry into the family that killed her family.
Right.
So it's not just like this is a political marriage, because he could have found her, you know, a lord in plenty of other places. He could have found her someone in Dorne. The Dornes hate the Lannisters. Marry Sansa to someone in Dorne. You know, like, there are other powerful allegiances that she could have made. But he's picking Winterfell and the Boltons specifically for Sansa to be in, like, back in her home. And find a way. And I, like I said, I really promise you guys listening, I'm not spoiling things because this is not what happens in the books.
Right. Like, this is purely your speculation.
My speculation, yeah. 100%, that putting Sansa in Winterfell, given whatever is cooking up in Littlefinger's head, puts her in a position to get revenge for what happened on the Boltons.
Gotcha. Interesting, yeah. Well, that would certainly – like, Sonia Soraya at Salon.com wrote a pretty interesting piece about how this move gives Sansa more agency than she had in the books, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Everything they've done for Sansa is amazing, right, in my opinion. Because I've talked about this before. You know, part of it I think has to do with the actors growing up. And so Sansa in the book is still a little girl, and Sophie Turner is a young woman. the same is true with Jon, right? So you can't have Sansa doing what she did. You know, Sansa in early seasons was so young that when she was being like a silly little girl about Joffrey, it made more sense.
Right.
But you would just not be with that character if she were behaving the same way now.
Right. Agreed completely with you about that. And so, yeah, it feels like they've really evolved this character.
Yeah.
If only you could express such love for the Ollie character, Jon Robinson, then my dreams would truly have come true.
But can I explain at least initially what happens in the book so
sure.
that you
yeah,
know?
I mean, I want to hear, like, it sounds like you are a huge fan of these non-book developments, so I want to hear why that's the case.
Well, so basically it's efficiency of storytelling because you're slotting Sansa into a role that was served by someone else.
Right.
And basically what happens in the book is the Boltons feel like they need a Stark in order to hold the North, which is what Stannis feels like too. Like, this is the message you hear over and over again, is that the North won't, like, adhere to any ruler that does not have some sort of Stark line associated with them, right? Yeah. It's why the Lannisters married Tyrion to Sansa. The Starks have this power to sway the North, the Stark name. So what happens in the books is that the Boltons find this girl named Jane Poole, who is actually a friend of Sansa's from childhood, and claim she's Arya Stark because Arya Stark has been missing forever. So she's a fake Arya Stark that they plan to marry to Ramsay. So, like, can you imagine if the show tried to do that? They're like, here's this girl. She's, I mean, they could have gotten away with it, but it just makes so much more sense and it's so much better to just, you have a Stark girl. Just slot a real Stark girl into that role rather than have a fake Arya and have Sansa, like, hanging around at the Eyrie or whatever. So.
Fascinating.
I think it's so much more interesting for that character and just efficiency. You know, like, over and over again, that's what they do in the show, is the more Jar Jar Martin adds these extraneous characters from the books, the more the show is like, what character do we already have that we could use in that role instead so as not to confuse someone with 100 new characters?
It actually does remind me of Zack Snyder's Watchmen movie.
Mm-hmm.
That movie, I'm not going to spoil what happens. I will say that there is a major thing that's introduced at the end of that movie, or at the end of the book, that they just use an existing character for in the movie. And it strikes me as a similar thing where, like, if we can use existing characters to fulfill plot points, it's a better, like, it's more economic that way.
Right.
So
it's a necessary evil of adaptation, I think.
Well, can unexpectedly be a benefit. I mean,
absolutely.
Like, Sansa as a character is much better now in the show than she is in the books at this point, right?
Agreed. Yeah. Yeah.
Much more rich and interesting. So.
Yeah. And the thing I want to say, or the other thing I want to, like, draw people's attention to, you might have, I don't know, some people missed it, so I just want to point it out that in the courtyard scene when Sansa's first introduced to Roos and then Ramsay, they pan over to a girl, and that's Miranda, who was Ramsay's, like, companion last season. She was like a low level character. So I think a lot of people were like, why is the camera lingering on this girl? So that's who she is. She's the one who was, like, hunting with him last season.
Right.
Having sex with him last season. So that's basically Ramsay's girlfriend who's not happy that Sansa's there.
And there was also, like, a more portly woman. I believe that was Roose Bolton's wife.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Who is a Frey daughter, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha. I always, like I said, I talked about this a couple weeks ago, but I always love how, like, when the plot lines almost intersect, and here Sansa and Theon almost interact again for the first time in, for us, it's been years, you know, and I think in the show it's also been years. It's definitely been a while.
I think since the first episode.
Yeah, yeah. And it always feels transgressive when the plot lines intersect, and because you wonder, like, is Theon going to tell her, hey, Ramsay is a psychopath. You need to get away from him, or at least figure out a way to kill him as soon as possible. You know, like, is that going to happen? It creates a lot of tension. I love it. So,
and how long can Theon duck her? This is when I was watching it, I was thinking about how Agent Scully on X-Files, like, always just misses the aliens. I kind of feel like Theon is, like, the alien, and Sansa's just wandering around. It's like, oh, you just, he's just there. Now he's gone.
Yep. Well, so we'll see.
Yeah.
The thing is, in that series, they were able to drag that out for quite some time. So
yeah.
I feel like it's not going to be dragged out quite as long, but you never know with this show. You never know. So
that'd be hilarious if Alfie Allen spent the whole season just, like, ducking behind veils and stuff.
I don't think it'd be that hilarious. So what else is worth pointing out? So there's tension between Bolton and Littlefinger. Bolton obviously feels like Littlefinger has betrayed the Lannisters. So how can he? How can Bolton trust Littlefinger? Right.
Right.
And he gets a note from Cersei. And do we know what that note is?
No, I mean I do, but you don't.
Just that Cersei wanted to emphasize the word immediately.
She needs a response immediately, whatever it is.
And other than that, we don't have any information.
Right.
So,
and she thinks he's still at the Eyrie. She does not know he's at Winterfell.
Right.
That's the other information we got. Yeah, but it is like an uneasy alliance. Oh, the other information, I guess, is, you know, the question, the book question that doesn't make sense is, you know, Sansa married Tyrion. How could she marry Ramsay now? And I guess the show explanation is since she never consummated her marriage to Tyrion, which is true. It doesn't count.
They're not married by common law or whatever the hell he called it. Like some kind of regular.
And he was like really eager to have her test. He's like, have her tested.
Yeah, which like what on earth?
And Bruce
even-
is like, that's no.
That's not necessary. I don't like. I've already told you five times, Littlefinger. You don't need to do that.
We're okay.
So I don't even know what that would involve, but I'm guessing it would be unpleasant. Anything else to mention about this plotline? Just that Brienne and Pod had a really nice moment.
I mean, and that's another – oh, God, Brienne's speech about like being at the ball and talking about Renly and talking about Stannis. I really liked that. I love their stuff.
Is that in the book?
Okay, so if I tell you that Sansa doesn't go to Winterfell in the books, then Brienne tracking Sansa to Winterfell is obviously not in the book. So, her plot also has more, you know, like if you want to talk about Sansa having more agency, Brienne has more purpose because she's actively tracking a Stark girl.
Right. Whereas, wow. Yeah. So there's all these characters that are like way off book now.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
And it's converging, right? Like you already talked about how it's like thrilling that, you know, Theon and Sansa are in the same frame.
Right. Imagine if Brienne comes and like rescues her or something.
Like that's three, you know, and that's what's happening. I mean, we'll get to that. In the next section we talk about, but that's sort of happening all over the place. You know, we already have Stannis at the wall, you know, like we've got Jaime allegedly going to Dorne, you know, like we just have these plot lines converging in a really satisfying way, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I thought that speech was very moving as well. So good stuff there. And she's offering to train Pod. So maybe that's going to become a thing too. Maybe he'll become like Deadly Warrior or something one day. I bet she's going to save – well, no.
Pod in the sheets and Pod in the streets.
Nice. In a typical show, he would save her in a decisive, you know, battle of some sort.
But being Game of Thrones.
Being Game of Thrones, they'll probably both die horribly. So finally, the final plot line of Volantis, I will say this kind of was spoiled a little bit for me in the previously on where they showed Ser Jorah.
Yeah.
Like riding away, and it's like, okay, well, why would you show that unless Ser Jorah is going to come back?
Yeah,
this episode?
Big bummer. I think they did the same thing with Jack and Hagar. Like, those previously ons are, I don't recommend.
Yeah, skip those if you can. So, they get to Volantis, like, Tyrion doesn't want to stay in the wooden box. I guess a few things worth pointing out here. Number one, so what religion – that woman, the Asian woman, she's kind of like a Melisandre.
Yeah.
She's like an Asian Melisandre essentially, right?
Mm-hmm.
So she's preaching the fire god, not the sparrow god, correct?
Right. Well, the sparrows follow the seven.
The seven, right.
They're
the seven.
Polytheistic.
She's monotheistic, right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, she gives that creepy look to Tyrion, which is like awesome and very disquieting.
Yeah.
We learn that Tyrion can no longer have sex with prostitutes, apparently. Like, I guess
since he murdered one.
Since he murdered one, he's not into it anymore, which
I guess
is a very significant break from his previous character. And also that people like having sex with people that look like Daenerys Targaryen.
Right? Yeah, I guess in King's Landing, it's people who look like the Seven Gods, and in Volantis, it's people who look like a bottomless Dany. I mean, I really did like how quickly they established that they're in Dany territory. Because, like, you get to the Red Priestess is talking about the Dragon Queen. And then you get to the brothel and there's, you know, a prostitute looks like Daenerys.
Right.
So even though we haven't been to Volantis before, this is the first time we've ever been to Volantis. Like, you know that this is her territory. So by the time that Jorah says, I'm taking you to the queen, we know which queen he's talking about. He's right. not talking about Cersei. He's not talking about Margaery because he's in Daenerys territory. Right. So,
The bottomless prostitute was actually used for a very valuable expository purpose
so.
In this episode.
Yeah. I think so, yeah. And I did want to mention the bridge. I mean, the long bridge of Volantis, as described in the book, I think they did such a good job translating
great.
That to the screen. They filmed Cordoba, Spain, I think. So like an actual really old Roman bridge in Spain. And I just thought it one of the more like stunning establishing shots of the series.
It was very good. It was very impressive, yeah.
But if someone wasn't spoiled that Jorah was coming, I loved how they introduced him. Because, you know, I watched a screener, so I saw no previously on. I didn't know Jorah was coming. So the first shot you get is his arm slamming a drink down.
Right, and you know it's someone significant, because why would they focus on that arm? That
yeah, and if you're in love with Ser Jorah, as I am, you recognize his, decorative arm braces that he wears.
You recognize that orientation of arm hair. And you're like, that is classic Jorah
That's so Jorah.
It's so Jorah.
It's so Mormont.
I was just thinking of like, you know, do we fetishize people who beautiful people who hold positions of power in our day? And that still kind of does happen, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, it reminds me of
Sarah Palin pornography. That's kind of what that was my first reaction.
Oh, it reminds me of L.A. Confidential, right? Where the prostitutes would cut themselves like Lana Turner or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's a more extreme example, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, we both of our minds went to really dark places as a result of that plot line, I think is the take-home message here.
Yeah.
So then Jorah kidnaps Tyrion. And, you know, Varys is not super happy with that, I'm sure. So the thing about that is, like, it totally changes the dynamic, right? Like, it's one thing if Tyrion demands an audience with Daenerys and, like, he's coming on his own terms. It's another thing if he's, like, delivered in a sack by Jorah.
Right.
So, really intense stuff. Really great way to end an episode. And, like, one of the few times I think that, like, really is truly a cliffhanger on the show.
Yeah, I agree.
Like, it's like, wow, that was a major event, and I really can't wait to know what happens next.
And, I mean, usually a lot of the times we end with Daenerys. There was no Daenerys at all in this episode, which is unusual.
Yeah.
But a lot of times they end with Daenerys, and I liked that they ended with
– Any other plot lines that we didn't see this episode other than Daenerys? We didn't see anything from Dorne again.
Yeah.
Anything else? I think that was it, right?
And like, Jaime, who I guess is on the way to Dorne. So.
Yes, with Bronn, presumably.
Right.
Any other thoughts on this episode overall or about that last scene?
I did want to mention a news story that broke today, just because I know that there are people who listen to this who get annoyed by smug book readers. So I don't know if you saw the story where Nikolai Coster-Waldau admitted on Conan last night that he dropped fake spoilers for book readers just to mess with them.
That is freaking awesome.
And I mean, like, I was involved in this. Like, I wasn't sure if it was a fake or whatever, but he recorded this message for Nordic HBO. And at the end, he, like, holds up a duck. And he's like, this one's for the book readers. I'm not going to spoil anything, but think about it. And, like, the book readers, like, it's easy to extrapolate it to something, but the book readers just chase their tails. And then he admitted, like, I just made that up just because I thought it was hilarious.
That is amazing.
And what was I going to say? You know, and Conan pointed out, which is totally true, that he could hold up anything and book readers would find a way to be like, oh, well, clearly that's an allusion to this.
Yeah.
So we know that this is coming, you know.
Right.
So
right.
It was pretty great. Jaime, you're so incorrigible.
So overall, I thought this was a really solid episode. Really liked it a lot.
Such a good John episode.
Yeah, great John episode. And I think like a lot of elements of like letting go or holding on to the past, right? We have like Arya with that moment where she kind of can't let go. We have Jon with that moment that calls back to Ned Stark's beheading in the first episode of the entire series. And Tyrion having that moment of like, can't like, you know, get with a prostitute. Like the whole thing of like connecting people with their past, I thought was a really great theme that was brought to life in the episode. So
yeah.
Any other thoughts, or shall we wrap it up for today? We've gone way long.
I know. This is really long. Yeah. But, well, that's to make up for the fact that we made people wait.
So yes. There you go. Well, thank you guys for listening. Where can I find more of your work on the internet, Jonah Robinson?
I don't know. You might have heard somewhere that you can find me on vanityfair.com.
I can't imagine where.
Or you can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This, or you can hear me talking about Game of Thrones book spoilers on a Storm of Spoilers podcast.
Find one of my other podcasts at bigproblemspodcast.com and another one of my podcasts at slashfilmcast.com. Thank you for listening to A Cast of Kings. We'll see you guys next week.